You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how milk from Wisconsin's dairy farmers gets priced and how low prices are affecting milk producers around the state. First, we'll be talking about the issue of suicide for the next few minutes. If you or someone you know has talked or thought about suicide, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or use the online Lifeline Crisis Chat, both available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The United States is continuing to see an increase in suicide numbers, and many times we don't think of older adults as being a part of that picture. But a six-month investigation looking into suicide rates in long-term care facilities, places like nursing homes or assisted living centers, suggests that we need to be paying closer attention to the older population. Jonelle Alicia is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Melissa Bailey is a correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Both cover aging and end-of-life issues. Jonelle, Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, Jonelle, let's start with you. We've heard and talked about the number of suicides that occur on the U.S. in the show before, but we don't usually think about that senior population. From your reporting, how common is this, and why don't we hear so much about it?
You're right. Most people don't think about suicides in the senior population, especially the long-term care population. Statistics actually show that suicides are particularly common in men who are older than 65, particularly white men. But our research found a couple of things that nobody really tracks suicides that occur in long-term care. And previous research has shown that the rate of suicide is about the same in the community as in long-term care, even though many families put their loved ones in, seek long-term care because they want that extra supervision and care. So from data from researchers at the University of Michigan, which we extrapolated to the entire U.S., it suggests that hundreds of suicides by older people are related to long-term care each year. Suicides of people actually in these facilities or people transitioning to the facilities or caregivers of those folks.
And Melissa, you looked into a few cases here in the state of Wisconsin, which I understand is one of the few states that actually tracks these issues. What can you share with us about what's going on here in Wisconsin?
So yes, Wisconsin is one of the few states that actually requires these incident reports and will tell you how many suicides are occurring in long-term care. So I requested these records from 2012 to 2017, and we found 13 official reports of suicides in Wisconsin nursing homes or assisted living. So that's only a couple per year that are reported, although it's not clear how many other cases get missed. And so these are people, you know, this is people who are dying, but common methods might be like a hanging or a suffocation or exiting through a window. And we were able to reach one family in Waukesha that lost their father to suicide in late 2017. And they were just devastated by his death and really surprised by it.
And can you, Melissa, tell us a little more about their story that they were willing to share with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So the man was named Larry Anders. He was a lifelong machinist and an Army veteran. He lived in the suburbs of Milwaukee. And he was a low-key guy, never complained, liked to garden and watch TV, like Wheel of Fortune with his wife. But at the end of 2017, he was 77 years old, and he was going through a really difficult time. So his wife of 51 years, Lorna, passed away. And then very shortly after that, he discovered he had stage 4 throat cancer, which is a really grim diagnosis. And so Larry Anders, he initially said, you know, I don't want to go through all this chemotherapy, all this treatment. But then he kind of agreed to give it a try. And he ended up at a nursing home in Burlington, which was about 40 minutes away from his home. And when he got there, his children were so concerned about the quality of care that they were just camping out day and night watching over him. He was having anxiety and insomnia and just really not adjusting well. And he didn't last there more than a week. So one morning, his son was sleeping, you know, in the chair next to his bed. His son left for work. And very shortly after that, Larry Anders took his own life in his room in the nursing home.
Now, Janelle, that tragedy for that Wisconsin family, it fits some common themes, a transition, as Melissa was saying, health problems, maybe the loss of a loved one. These are things that people going into some kind of a senior facility might well be dealing with on a pretty regular basis. Are there systems in place or prevention efforts focusing on people in that kind of situation?
We found that there are some programs that are pretty rare that actually address suicide in these settings. The experts that we talked to all emphasized to us that there is so much more that can be done. Even though there are requirements to monitor and screen seniors for suicidal thoughts and behaviors, often those don't get translated into direct care in the centers themselves. We spoke to one psychologist out in Wenatchee, Washington, who has started a pilot project to train providers in nursing homes and assisted living centers for the signs to watch for to help prevent suicides in these settings. And she also wants to make it more possible for the residents to mentor each other because they often know of the issues when staff don't. But it was pretty hard to find providers or experts who were actively intervening in this way.
And Melissa, as we mentioned, Wisconsin is one of the few states that requires these kind of incidents be reported. Did you get a sense that that was focusing more attention on it? It was maybe rallying prevention efforts in Wisconsin that might not be present in other states?
We did not identify particular interventions in Wisconsin that we didn't see in other states. I mean, I certainly didn't, do a comprehensive look in Wisconsin by itself, but in many states, this issue is happening, and it seems like when you look at who's getting funded for research into elderly suicide, there really isn't many resources devoted to this issue.
And Janelle, did that surprise you as you and Melissa did this reporting that this was so in many ways under the radar?
Yeah, it really did surprise us. One of the really surprising things was we took a look at funding for suicide prevention, and there were so many more resources devoted to suicide in young people, suicide in middle-aged people, because those are certainly an issue that we've heard a lot about. But we were surprised to see that prevention efforts in this population were pretty neglected.
And Janelle, in our last minute or so, you write in the piece that this is a problem that we're going to have to watch for most as our population ages, as more and more baby boomers hit ages where they move into these facilities. Are we ready for this?
Boy, it doesn't appear that we are. Our research showed us that by 2030, all baby boomers will be older than 65, and one in five U.S. residents will be of retirement age. And, the baby boom generation, surprisingly, has had higher rates of suicide at every stage along the way. And so experts are saying we're really kind of bracing ourselves to see these issues that may be showing up in middle-aged folks and early elders, that they're thinking that a rise in suicide is going to continue as we go forward. And so it's an important issue to watch.
Janelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Melissa Bailey and Janelle Alicia, correspondents for Kaiser Health News. They're both reporting on aging and end-of-life issues. They join us to talk about their piece. You can read it at Kaiser Health News. It's called Lethal Plans When Seniors Turn to Suicide in Long-Term Care. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, again, is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. Coming up, with Wisconsin dairy farmers continuing to see low milk prices, we'll look at the complicated system that sets those prices. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is planning a trip to Green Bay later this month. We'll talk about how the Midwest is already playing a big role in the presidential race for the president and a growing field of Democratic challengers. First, dairy farmers continue to deal with low milk prices. And as the industry and regulators continue to look for more solutions, one area that's getting a closer look is the system that sets most of the country's milk prices. It's a system that's notoriously complicated, and our next guest recently spent some time trying to break down how it works. Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext. He's the author of two new articles on the milk pricing system. You can see those at wiscontext.org. Will, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, looking at milk prices, a big concern, obviously, for dairy farmers around Wisconsin. In a nutshell, how these prices are set is complicated, right? What goes into it?
It's super complicated. A lot of things go into it. It depends on where you are. In Wisconsin, it's dependent on federal regulations. It includes kind of basic supply and demand economics, but as well as a bunch of other things that are that the federal government requires in terms of classified pricing, price pooling, all sorts of stuff.
And things like the price of cheddar, the cheddar price we see at the stores, that is an icon. Not all cheeses, but cheddar factors into what farmers get paid for that raw milk.
Right. So one of the things that goes into the value of milk is they determine the value of milk by different components that are in the milk. And so one of those components is protein. And they determine the value of protein by the value of specific weights of cheddar cheese. And it's been like that for a long time. I think it's because we consume a lot of cheddar in this country.
Now, you have a chart in one of your pieces that really paints a dire picture. We look at the nominal price, what the price tag on that that milk right now. But you did one inflation adjusted going back to before the Great Depression. And tell us what we see when we look at that.
Right. So what you see in the inflation adjusted milk prices is quite a bit of swinging. It plummets in the Great Depression, which makes sense. And then the milk prices pretty much recover after that through the late 70s. In the beginning in the 1980s, even though the real price for milk has kind of steadily gone up since then, it has not kept up with inflation. And really, so the effective price of milk has really plummeted since the early 80s.
And we saw the prices go up a few years back. You write that that led some farmers to produce more milk. But even with that increase, it wasn't keeping up with inflation, and it's dropped again since then, right?
Right, yeah. It's been dropping since a high in 2014. The price of milk has fallen close to 30% and has kind of hovered around there since then.
And this is obviously putting financial stress on most dairy farmers here in the state.
Yes, it is. We've been losing dairy herds at a record pace in 2018. A lot of counties have seen upwards of 25-30% dairy herd loss in the last few years.
Now, you talked to some industry experts about the changes that have happened over the last decades. Is there talk about changing the complicated way that milk is priced?
Yes, there is. I know that the USDA is planning to go to a new hearing possibly this year or next to see about tweaks to the pricing system, which, again, is really complicated. If listeners want to hear more about that, I definitely would recommend going to our content on WisContext.
But they would be taking comments from dairy farmers and, in theory, trying to rebuild this system from the ground up?
Yeah, literally anyone can participate in those hearings and can offer recommendations. And then the USDA can only draw from those recommendations that come in during those public hearings in making rule changes.
Well, thanks a lot for the whirlwind tour.
Sure.
We've been talking about milk prices with Will Cushman from WisContext. Now for more on this, we turn to Mark Hagedorn, a UW Extension agriculture agent in Eau Claire County. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, we were just hearing some about the low dairy prices farmers are experiencing. Can you talk about what you're seeing on the ground with farmers figuring it out if they can stay in business?
Yeah, it's been a real challenge ever since we had our height of this cycle in 2014, pardon the pun, milk prices have really gone in the tank. And, it's been a struggle because our input expenses, cost, purchase feed, seed, petroleum products for tractor, gas, fuel, oil, those kind of things have stayed constant or maybe even gone up while milk prices are continuing to stay down or sometimes even edge a little bit further in the wrong direction. So cash flows on farms have been a real problem. This has been resulting in people really needing to examine just exactly what their business plan should look like and if they need to make some changes in that business plan in order to save the equity they have left in their operation.
What kind of changes are dairy farmers making in their business plan that can help them navigate, especially these lower prices?
I think what we're seeing, producers are looking at going from dairying, you know, your very traditional, conventional milking cows two or three times a day and totally exiting and just raising row crops. That would be an option. Talk to a lot of producers that are looking at phasing out the milk cows, continuing to raise heifers, and maybe introducing feedlot steers. The beef price is still one of those few shiny objects that are out there on the horizon where people can get a little bit better return on their investment. So they're able to continue doing the thing they love, which is farm. They're just doing it with different moving parts.
How difficult is it to make these decisions given that you're deciding based on what the prices are today, but you might the animal you buy today might not be in production, might not be sellable, might not be producing milk until the prices have changed down the road?
Well, you've got to take a long-range plan look at this, and that's one thing that we've gotten pretty good at over the years is taking a look at numbers we've got in production, what we're able to produce now, what we'd be looking at for cash flow a year down the road. And while we're doing this, we're taking into account just how much debt retirement we're able to account for, what our cost of production is. And you put all those moving parts together, and then you have to make that decision as to, are we going to continue playing the game, or are we going to adjust what we're doing and how we're doing it.
Now, when I go to the store, I see a lot of different kinds of cheese on the market of varying prices. I know cheddar is one of the anchors for the price that the farmer's milk is set at. For premium cheeses, for higher cost cheeses, are farmers getting, I guess, their fair share of the cost of that final product when they sell their milk?
That's a difficult question to answer. I suppose it's going to depend on who you ask. When you take a look at higher end cheeses versus your more generic lines of cheese, you've got to understand that aged cheeses are in fact aged. So that's inventory that's been sitting in a environmentally controlled chamber for years, potentially 8 to 10 years for a good aged cheese. So there's a lot of money, time, and infrastructure invested in that by the middle person. So that is certainly not leaking back down to the dairy farmer. Dairy producers are very conscious of the protein, butterfat levels in their milk. They're also very conscious about quality aspects such as somatic cell count and bacteria. You do a good job with all four of those, and you will get a premium from the processor, which makes your milk check a little bit larger. But it also costs a bit more to feed a cow to get higher component tests with butter, fat, and protein. So it's a moving scale. And you also have to bear in mind, Rob, that 90% of Wisconsin's fluid milk is turned into cheese. Mm-hmm. There's very little fluid milk processed in the state. So, and then once you get the 90% of that milk turned into cheese, a lot of that is exported to other parts of the country or into our largest export neighbor, Mexico. The dairy industry is no longer just a state or a regional thing. It's a world market, and it's a supply and demand market, just like any other commodity that we deal with in life.
Milk pricing has been changed. The formula has been changed a couple times over the decades. Is it due for a new tweak?
Another good question, and I think that depends on who you ask. There are several entities across the United States that are having a real hard discussion on supply management strategies. And with one or two of these supply management strategies, they're looking at taking all of our federal milk marketing orders and combining them into one. Right now, we have federal milk marketing orders for multiple areas of the United States, and the equations that are utilized in these different areas, there are a lot of components in that equation to help determine how pricing in different parts of the country pans out. Sort of a fun story for those of us that live in the Eau Claire area. Back in the day, the Eau Claire milk price was sort of the center of the hub of Class 3 milk pricing. But that epicenter has now started to move out and away from here just by virtue of the industry and the age of our producers, the size of our farms. Considerably more milk is produced on the east side of the state than here in the west, but there's still certainly a good dairy tradition here.
We'll leave it there, Mark. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
That was Mark Hagedorn with UW Extension in Eau Claire with us to talk about some of the market challenges in the dairy industry. To read more about that and how dairy prices are set, go online to wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Congress is getting ready for the release of the redacted version of the Mueller report tomorrow. We'll find out what questions people are still looking to have answered. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at President Trump's recent veto of a resolution that would have ended U.S. military support for one side of the war in Yemen. First, we take a look at some of the big stories this week in national politics. President Trump's feud with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was elevated this week after he sent out a controversial tweet. Washington is getting ready for the release of the Mueller report tomorrow, a redacted version, and President Trump will be visiting Green Bay on April 27th, the same night as the White House Correspondents' Dinner in D.C. Our question for you this week, when people running for president visit Wisconsin, what do you want to hear them say about things that would affect the state and the Midwest? Have you been to a rally for the president or a Democratic candidate? What do you listen for? Are you planning to go catch someone speaking? Do you simply watch for who takes the time to show up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Neuhauser is a staff correspondent at the National Journal. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, President Trump shared a video on Twitter this week of Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. She was speaking at a recent event, and then that was edited together with images from the September 11th attacks. The video contained just a small bit of her speech. Give us some background on what has been controversial here.
Critics of Omar have accused her of downplaying the attacks in New York on 9/11 by saying almost flippantly is the assertion that some people did something. Her larger point in the context of what she was saying was that the Muslim community writ large suffered with regards to civil rights in the aftermath of 9/11. And her point was some people did something and the rest of us had to bear the brunt of it. But they've sort of isolated those comments and made it sound as if, you know, as if she's saying, oh, it was just a little something. It's gotten quite ugly. There is certainly a large microscope on Omar. The things that she says are analyzed several different ways to a degree that I would assert that a lot of other members don't get that kind of criticism. At the same time, she doesn't shy away from it. She has been critical of Israel and other sort of third rails of American politics. And so now, unfortunately, she said that there's been an uptick in death threats since the president's tweet and the controversial New York Post cover and other critical coverage of her, both in media and from her colleagues in politics. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has asked for there to be a special security assessment to make sure that she's safe. So it's gotten quite drastic in the last week or so.
Now, President Trump was asked on Monday if he regretted the tweet, in part in light of the death threats you mentioned, Dan. He said he didn't. Here's a bit of what he had to say about Representative Omar.
It's unfortunate. She's got a way about her that's very, very bad, I think, for our country. I think she's extremely unpatriotic and extremely disrespectful to our country.
Is this something you expect to see more of, the president calling attention to this particular Democratic representative, or is this one of many Twitter targets and we may see this move on?
Not just the president, but the entire party. It's clear that they're going to make Ilhan Omar a point of controversy for political gain. Already, former Minnesota Governor Norm Coleman, with his political group, the American Action Network, is running ads in House battleground districts, asking for that Democrat, the sort of endangered Democrat who represents that district, to disavow Ilhan Omar. So it's clear this is going to be a concerted strategy moving forward, asking Democrats to distance themselves from Omar. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it pop up even in you know, sort of small-time House races in the course of this election.
Talking to Daniel Neuhauser from the National Journal about some of the big news in national politics. The Mueller report, Dan, people have been talking about this, wondering what was in it for a long time. We saw this four-page summary from the new attorney general. Now we get a redacted version coming out tomorrow. First off, who is actually supposed to get copies of the report tomorrow?
Well, everybody. They're going to post it on the Justice Department website. And actually, just minutes ago, Attorney General William Barr and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced that they are going to have a press conference at 9:30 a.m. Eastern tomorrow. So I expect that's our time for when we'll be able to finally read this you know, critical report.
Now, this thing is supposed to be hundreds of pages in its full form. I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of people across the political spectrum making judgments on that report early in the day tomorrow who probably haven't read the whole thing. Should we maybe be a little cautious for those first reports tomorrow, Dan?
Yes. I think all of my colleagues in media, I urge you to shun the quick bad take and you know, read the thing before we start opining on it.
And one of the big questions that we can't answer till it's out is how much will be redacted from this report? What have we heard from the attorney general about the kinds of things that will be closed off to the public, that will be redacted in the Mueller report?
Yeah, there's going to be, you know, sources and methods, which basically protects, you know, spycraft, that kind of stuff, and, you know, unindicted individuals who to protect their, you know, their privacy and things like that. The hope is that there's not going to be any excessive redaction that would appear to be redacted only for the purpose of protecting the president. But, you know, I don't want to speculate too much because we haven't seen this thing yet. But certainly Democrats are wary of anything like that.
And I think one thing we can speculate about with some accuracy, both sides are going to try to make political hay out of whatever is in this report. Is that fair to say, Dan?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be probably similar to what happened after Barr put out that four-page summary interpretation of the report after he got it. Republicans are already quite dug in on saying that no collusion did occur. Barr seemingly confirmed that, and Democrats want to see, how Mueller interpreted that, whether there in fact was, no grounds for collusion altogether, or if it was just, a case couldn't be made for it. And then, of course, the obstruction question is probably the bigger question still hanging out there. Mueller said Barr seemed to indicate that Mueller said there may be evidence on both sides of this. But Mueller left it up to Barr or to Congress to interpret whether or not there'd be enough to charge. My guess is that it's going to fall along political lines whether or not people think that the president did in fact this or not.
We'll be taking some early looks at the report tomorrow on Central Time at 4:30, and then NPR News will have a special tomorrow at 7 on the details of the Mueller report. That's all here on the Ideas Network. President Trump coming to Green Bay on April 27th, Dan, holding a rally there. It's the same night as the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I think everybody expected him to skip that. Why do you think we're getting so much love, first of all, from the president here in Wisconsin and around the Midwest?
Well, you got to remember, he basically won the presidency with great lakes adjacent states. He won Wisconsin. He won Michigan for the first time since a Republican president won it since the 80s. He won Pennsylvania, which put him over the top on election night. And famously, his opponent, Hillary Clinton, enough, I think, most autopsies of her election loss figure that she did not do enough to court voters in the Midwest, maybe even took for granted their support. So now we see, for instance, the DNC is going to be held in Milwaukee already. Several high-profile 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls are talking about the Midwest, courting Midwestern voters. I think it's going to be critical in the middle of all the action.
We're talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some of the week's big political news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on what we were just talking about with Wisconsin and the Midwest getting so much attention for the 2020 race. What do you want to hear from the president when he comes to Wisconsin, from Democratic candidates when they come here? What should they be saying to people who live here? What are the issues you want them to be focusing on? And have you gone to a political rally for President Trump, for one of the Democratic challengers? What did you see there? Did it change or confirm your opinion of a candidate? And do you think it's important that a candidate visits the state? Will that help sway your vote, say, in the Democratic primary? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about some of the week's top political news with Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal, asking you now what you want to hear from presidential candidates when they come to Wisconsin. We've had them here already. We're going to have more. Presidents coming later this month. We'll see Democratic candidates, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Dave with us in Cross Plains. Dave, hi.
Hi there. Regarding the Democratic field, what I'd like to hear is some discussion of why so much money is going to military adventurism around the world, defense spending, the new proposed Space Force, which takes money out of the commons, meaning education, high-speed trains. There's lots of opportunity to help citizens here rather than putting weapons in space. The other piece from the Dems I'd like to hear about is some support for journalism regarding Julian Assange. Information should not be held back just because it's detrimental to foreign policy mistakes that have been made. Lastly, the Democratic field that appears to think that all Democrats are on board with open borders. Now, I'm a Democrat. I'd like to see that put to rest here so the Democrats don't get tagged with being open borders approach to immigration.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Gave us a lot to work with there. Let's take his last point first there, Dan, and talk about how Democrats are tackling the issue of immigration. As you heard there, not all Democrats want unrestricted access for immigrants. I don't know what candidates that are across the board there. What are you seeing from Democratic candidates on the immigration issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a point of contention with Trump. He's made immigration a central plank of his campaign, and he's quite content to do so because he thinks that it's a winning message. To be quite honest with you, Democrats nationally really try not to make that a big kitchen table issue. And I think your caller's comment is exactly why. They seem to believe that Democrats care about healthcare, education, and other issues like that, that immigration, as important as it is not something that they want to stake their campaigns on. Now, that said, it will come up, and there's going to be this natural tension with a field so large where any individual candidate can drive the entire field to the left. And we're seeing that with a lower-tier candidate, Julian Castro, who, as of right now, doesn't even have enough support to get on the debate stage. But he's staked out a very far left position on immigration, which is essentially decriminalizing border crossing. And I am very interested to see whether a position like that catches fire on the Democratic left, and if other candidates are going to be asked to take that position. And if that's the case, does it alienate some voters like your caller?
Thanks for the call. We're going out to Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, guys. I have two concerns here in the Midwest, or particularly in Wisconsin, that I'd like to hear them discuss. Would be infrastructure spending, transportation, electrical, communications, internet, things like that. Without having a strong infrastructure, our economy is basically going to become stagnant after a time. It's going to be outdated. Secondly, the trade issues are a big problem all over the country. I want to see progress in China and with Canada. I know a lot of Wisconsin dairy farmers kind of overexpose themselves into the market by overproducing goods, but we need to get that stabilized.
All right, Jeremy, I'm going to jump in because we've got a lot of other callers who want to weigh in, but I want to get to Jeremy's point there on infrastructure, Dan, a real bread and butter kind of focus. Are we seeing any Democrats taking out that position?
Absolutely. That's one of the top Democratic policy planks. They want to invest in infrastructure. The question is, how do you do it? They want to do it through government spending and sort of a stimulus. So if you remember the stimulus under President Obama, although they wouldn't want to use that terminology anymore because it's been politicized to the point of negativity. But Republicans, on the other hand, feel like that's obviously not the way that they would approach it. So I expect that there's going to be some small bore immigration measures infrastructure measures working their way through Congress in the middle of this year, and then potentially at the end of the year, some larger scale package. Nancy Pelosi has already started talking to President Trump about something like that. And I will be interested to see how Democratic candidates approach that. If there can be a deal between national congressional Democrats and President Trump, do 2020 Democrats who are trying to run against Trump distance themselves from that? Many of them are in the Senate. Will they have to vote on that? Will they have to agree with the person that they're running against? Or am I being entirely too hopeful here? And will an infrastructure package not even get halfway baked? That's a very real possibility, too.
Take another call now. Sean is with us in Stanley. Sean, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I didn't really know what I wanted to hear from any particular candidate or, Republican or Democrat. I'd just like to hear somebody say how they're going to actually do this stuff. I guess I'm just so tired of the rhetoric and the back and the forth and the, even President Trump saying, I'm going to make America great again. Well, if he's going to do it, do it. It's like, tell me how you're going to do it and actually take action. Just to talk to be talking, to hear yourself talk and boost your TV ratings is getting very tiresome. And
Sean, thanks a lot for calling in. Dan, stand by. I want to get to another caller or two before we move on from this issue of what people want to hear from candidates. Ann is with us in Green Bay. Ann, hi. What do you want to hear candidates talking about?
Well, I want to hear climate change because every other issue in this country, our economy, our health issues, our food sources, our water sources, our immigration issues, everything is going to revolve around climate issues and climate change and our climate crisis. That has got to be the number one issue.
And thanks a lot for that call. We'll have to do this again, maybe just to have callers weigh in on what they want to hear from candidates. Thanks to everyone who called in. Dan Neuhauser with us from the National Journal. I want to move on to a couple more issues before we run out of time. A lot of focus, of course, on the Democratic primary campaign. There is a primary challenge now, officially, I guess, against President Trump. What's going on?
Yeah, a former Massachusetts governor, not the one that you may be thinking that everybody had some hope would run against President Trump. It's not Mitt Romney. It's Bill Weld, the former vice presidential candidate on the Libertarian ticket last time around. He is coming out as a sort of a fiscally conservative but socially liberal Republican, and he stated his intention to challenge Trump in the primary. I can't imagine that he has too much of a chance, but he's staking his hopes on New Hampshire and some of the eastern seaboard states, and then moving into the Midwest, he thinks that he can give Trump a run for his money. More interestingly to me is the question of whether he will weaken Trump. If you look at the history of one-term presidents in the last couple of decades, they have often had a primary challenger. Now, it's not necessarily that primary challenger is so strong that they weaken the president, but the fact that there is a weakness to exploit attracts the primary challenger. So I'm really interested to see if Bill Weld can expose some fissures, because certainly there are people within the Republican Party who do not approve of Trump, his rhetoric, his divisiveness. And that's exactly what Bill Weld in his first campaign ad exploited. It almost looked like a campaign ad that I saw from the Hillary Clinton campaign. A lot of the same controversial remarks were used in the ad. So he's going for a return to sort of a Republican norms and more of a high-minded candidacy, not the sort of the Trumpian Republican Party that we have before us today.
And finally, Dan, you wrote about a Democratic bill in the U.S. House called the Equality Act, aiming to extend civil rights protections to LGBT people around the country. How is support for that shaping up?
Well, the interesting thing that I noted in my article about it is there is exactly one House Democrat who did not co-sponsor the bill. And just as soon as I wrote that article, he attracted a primary challenge on the left. This is Dan Lipinski, a noted moderate or even conservative Democrat. He voted against Obamacare. He is anti-abortion, and he is pro-religious freedom, which is his reason for not supporting the Equality Act, because this bill does tackle the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which would essentially allow people to discriminate against the LGBTQ community using religion as a basis for doing so. By and large, Democrats do not agree with that. They want to turn the page on that. But Lipinski, it does consider it a priority. His primary challenger last time around got incredibly close. I think it was about one percentage point away from beating him, but ultimately did not prevail. I expect that to be one of the most competitive primary challenges. But it's also playing out in the backdrop of a policy from the National Democratic Campaign Organization to essentially blacklist any vendors who work with primary challengers against an incumbent Democrat. So it does open up some very interesting questions about whether the National Party is going to be on the wrong side of some of these issues, especially the LGBTQ Equality Act.
We'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Anytime.
That's Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal. He was here to get us caught up on the week's news out of Washington. Still time for you to let us know what you think about Wisconsin and the Midwest being in the spotlight for the 2020 presidential election. What message should candidates be bringing to people here in the state? What do you want to hear them talking about, President Trump or the field of Democratic challengers, all of whom are coming to Wisconsin fairly often, it looks like? Let us know what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And by the way, join us tomorrow evening at 7 for an NPR News special on the details of the Mueller report. Attorney General William Barr provided a glimpse, a four-page glimpse of Robert Mueller's report on Russia's role in the 2016 U.S. election. On Thursday, it looks like we'll get some new details when the 400-page redacted document is expected to be released. It's tomorrow at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Bat Appreciation Day at here at Wisconsin Public Radio. When you think about appreciating bats, you think of Judith Sears Poisson. Judith, this is an exciting day for you.
It is, although I have to admit I forgot to wear my bat costume, which I did wear on Halloween. So, you know.
Did you forget or would you have?
I actually did
you were
forget.
Planning to wear
I thought
it?
I was considering it. I had not committed, but yeah, I have some pretty cool bat wings.
Now, you're a bat fan.
I am.
It's
I'm
fair
a
to
huge
say.
Bat fan.
But what is it that got you interested? I mean, bats are cool. I appreciate the mosquito eating part of their business that they do, but what you're beyond that.
I think they're just an amazing creature. And here in Wisconsin, you know, they actually work really hard for us. People think of the mosquitoes mm-hmm. that they save us from. There's that, but actually, Wisconsin's bats save farmers between $600 million and $1.5 billion in herbicides or insecticides that they don't have to put on their crops because they eat not just mosquitoes but all kinds of agricultural pests.
And you get up close and personal, right? You've participated in bat inventories
surveys,
and surveys.
Yeah, surveys. Trying to get a sense of how our population is doing because white nose syndrome is here. So we've seen some really big decreases in our cave bats, especially the little browns have really been affected by that. But also tagging, so we can follow bats and figure out where they're roosting. There's some species that we know where they go in the summer. We have no idea where they go in the winter. So there's still a lot to learn.
And briefly, you also find them adorable.
I do find them adorable. And I have several plush ones in my office.
Bat Appreciation Day here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.